Accession number 24192, reel 18.
Mr. Taylor, reel 18. Now, we got to the point where he took over as a sergeant major with the Tupin camp, HQ Allied Forces Central Europe. It was part of that anyway. In February 1968, you said. Now, you described the sort of composition of the camp.
Yep.
Now, what was your actual duties there as the camp sergeant major?
I was responsible for all the civilian cleaners, the civilian plumbers, the electricians. I accompanied the camp commander on his inspections around all the blocks, and I was in close contact with the American warrant officers, the German warrant officers, and the British Royal Signals. And anything that they wanted, or anything that came through to them, would come through me first. So everything that came into camp came through my office, so I knew exactly what was happening. And if something wasn't working right, then we'd sort it out with the commander. Where'd you get? And
sort of problems were you dealing with?
Well, you had the cleaners who came in, and you had to keep an eye on them. That they did the clubs, the international club, the junior ranks club, which was a separate setup. You had the electricians, the plumbers, so anything that any work that wanted done, you then went to them and said, look, this has got to be done, we need that done, and we'd either bring somebody in, either they'd do it, or they'd get somebody in from the headquarters to do it. There was also the RMP, who were the police in the camp. We used to work together on that for any problems that for security and that sort of thing within the camp. We never had any problems with the clubs or anything like that. I was a member of the committee on both clubs, the one in our camp and the main one at the Brunson headquarters. And we had used to have meetings once a month with the Americans, the Germans, the Canadians, talk about different things. People could come to me and said, look, we'd like this to happen for the clubs. We'd like this, if this could happen, this can happen. And we'd take that down on the monthly meeting. We'd all talk about it to different, they probably at the headquarters, the main club, they would have the same problems. And they'd try and sort of get it. Money again was the problem, and we got one or two things done for our club at a stage, and stage up so we could have a band or a night of something like bingo. The Dutch used to like bingo, and they were allowed in. A lot of the Americans who were living there as civilians, they were allowed to use the club as well, as they are in America. Ex-service people, and I used to work in the club as well as a night manager, and so that was quite lucrative actually. So that helped.
Well, how did the different nationalities get on together? I mean, was there any friction between any of them?
I can't remember any. I think there was more friction with them, between themselves than with each other, units. And I can't remember any problems at all within that camp. We always had a good understanding. I could wander around to any of the blocks, talk to any of them, any of the Germans, the Americans, or the Brits. And we had a few Canadians there as well, who were Canadian Air Force, who did the telephone work and that sort of thing within the setup. My wife ran the shop, the paper shop, book shop, which was run by a concessionaire. He used to deliver everything once a day, newspapers and this sort of thing, British newspapers, books. They opened sex shops in Maastricht while I was there. That was the first time that they've been allowed to do it. I think that would probably be 1969, I think, when they opened the sex shops. And that same day, that when they brought all the porn magazines and things in for the wife to sell in the shop. That's, didn't go down very well. But the men liked it. Used to come down and read a chapter, I think, a day. And that was good. The guy who used to deliver the papers, we used to get invited to his house. We went out for dinner with him and different things like that. The Dutch people were very good, very much like English, very much. I used to get on particularly well with the supervisor, electrician, and his brother-in-law. They were the sort of mainstays of the technical setup within the civilians. His brother-in-law had a complete map of all the tunnels underneath Maastricht, where the people used to walk in out and when they under the German occupation, and they knew exactly where they'd come up into somebody's kitchen and have a chat and all this sort of thing. It was very interesting. He used to talk to me about that. It was always very good. And Major Getz was an old time Dutch soldier who spent a lot of time in Indonesia. He was always on about his rice tafel and all this sort of thing. He spent a lot of time out there for some reason. Don't know why he spent so long out there, but he was a good man as well. We liked him. We also had an assistant commander who was a captain in the tanks and tank regiment. He was just about to retire as well. And overall, this is the sort of thing I used to do on a sort of daily basis.
But you obviously quite enjoyed the routine of it.
I did, yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah, because the family were settled. They had a good school, the American International School. I would take the wife into work when I went to work in the morning. And it used to work out very well. And when she finished in the afternoon, I was finishing as well. So we had a small naffy within the camp as well. So any Brits that wanted to use it could. And there wasn't a great deal. It was just something that we started. I tried to get it started anyway. And but there wasn't enough room actually to put in what you wanted to put in. And but they did run one at the main headquarters, which was quite a big one. So we went over there. We used to go over there and do some shopping. We spent most of the time spent a lot of time on the markets, the Dutch markets, especially in Brunsum. It was a good market on the Saturday. And the time for the buy the main veg and all this sort of thing for the family, have meals on there, and it was good. Maastricht, I liked Maastricht. It was there.
Now, how long were you there?
I was
February 68.
I was there until 71, and I think it was September 71. Like that, I think September 71. I think, yeah, about 3.5 years. I think spent there. And I was relieved by W01 in the, I think he was KOSB, if I can remember. He was married to a Dutch woman, so he wanted to stay there anyway when he finished. So I was relieved by him when I left. But that was a good job. I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Now what happened to the, you were now well past your service time, you know. You've been extended, but what happened now?
I took on for another 5 years to make sort of 8 years, which would take me up to, 48. And then I was posted to, in 71, posted to Cyprus. I went... I drove up to, with the way we went to Cyprus, I drove up to Venice and got a ferry from Venice to Cyprus, down the Med, called in at Crete. That's Heraklion. A couple of other places. And arrived at Limassol. Night of night. That was a good trip. So,
what were you going out to be or to join?
I was going out to be, again, running the stores and accommodation for the British support unit, the HQ near Elf, near East, in Episcopi.
What was the sort of setup of that?
I had a warrant officer, one, who was on the extended service, the same as me. One corporal storeman, one WROC, who was did the issues and that sort of thing. I was responsible for all the accommodation for the single people who lived in. Not the WROC, the men. And it's roughly the same setup as being a CQ match. You were responsible for making sure everything was, you had to do inspections and make sure everything was in order. Any changes, anything, any people coming in, allocation of beds and barrack rooms and all this sort of thing. And all the exchanges and everything done in exactly the same way through a quartermaster store setup. And this was the sort of thing that you went on on a daily basis. You got the stuff from the truck would come probably once a week, depending on what orders you'd made, from Decalia, the main stores in Decalia. And you would take it in, check it, everything in exactly the same way as before. And issue it if required, and get it down to the barrack blocks if required, mattresses and this sort of thing, bedding, blankets and that sort of thing, where the people would come and get their own. They would come in for exchange boots, exchange shirts, exchange all different parts of clothing and this sort of thing. Oh, the RAF were responsible for the armoury. Had an RAF armourer in there, so he was responsible for that. So if we needed anything, that we went through them, as opposed to I was looking after the weapons. I was part of the inter-services rifle team, rifle and pistol shooting team.
Tell us about, we've not done much about that.
We had our own HQ near Elf set up as far as the rifle team. And at the same time we had pistol team combined with the RAF. And we used to shoot against, sort of proxy used to shoot against people in the UK. We would fire and they'd send the targets away, and that's the thing, the results would come back. And we had quite a good team, actually.
What was the setup of a competition? You know, how would it work? What distance would you fire at, and how many rounds? What was the test?
When on the open range with the rifles, you'd fire probably, I think it used to work from 200 yards back to 600. And had a rifle which was a bolt action rifle at that time, very, very similar to the Ollie Enfield, but it was a bit more accurate when you got back to 600 yards. And I mean, taking then, I was getting on a bit, so to speak. And when you still had a rundown from sort of 500 yards to 400 to 300, firing at different targets as well at the same time. I mean, you were firing with other units within the, like, battalions who were stationed there. So you're running against young lads, and you had brain gun competitions and everything that was there. And I remember I got till the commander's 100, which I thought was pretty good at considering I was getting on a bit, as they say. And that's the sort of you used to fire sometimes. You fire your rapid fire, you fire single shots, and your competition would run. As I said, you do your rundown, firing at different targets, different size targets. And I think we got we done very well actually in that particular one that I can recall. The rifles.
What about pistol shooting?
Pistol shooting we used to do on the 30-meter range, which was sort of just off the just off the base. It's still there now, I think. And we also had an indoor range where we fired the 2-2. That was mostly the indoor shoot was mostly the competition with the UK. I can't remember exactly what the competition was called, but you would fire your targets and they would go to a central point and the UK would send it to that same central point and the points would be tallied and then the result would be sent back to us and to the UK. And we used to come out quite well on that as well. And we used to do a lot of practice. And you had your own individual competition, which I came runners up in one on 2-2. Used to fire the 2-2 pistol, and you had the old Lee Enfield, which was made to fire 2-2. Number 8, we used to call the number 8 rifle. And that was fired on the indoor range. That was we had quite a good competition with that as well. So it's, all in all, it was a good. We had a good team. And mostly senior rank sales. Senior ranks, on WO1, who's my boss with, he was part of the, as well. We had a wing commander in the area, a major. It was a good setup, and we always had a good results. And the work side of it overall was once you got things sorted out to your way of working, it went quite well. The quarters were very good, married quarters. Unlike they were all on the bungalow setup, and it was the stay there. I stayed there for 3 years.
Till 74 then?
Till 74, yeah.
Now, how about, what about all this move? Well, it's not that often moving, but did you feel it was disrupting your marriage and your children's education, things like that? Was there a problem there at all?
It wasn't a big problem. It probably took them a little while to settle down, but the wife didn't mind. She sort of take it as it comes. So, she was quite happy. The children weren't very happy. I mean, the setup for the kids in Cyprus was ideal. The school was less than 10 minutes down the road, the main school that they went to, which was a good school actually.
So they soon settled in.
Oh yeah, settling very good, settling very well. And then you had the beach, of course. I mean, used to finish school at 1 o'clock, and we used to finish work at 1 o'clock, so everybody were off. In the afternoon, so it's down to the beach or down to the town, the shopping or something like that. In the end, we had our own cinema on the base, so in the evenings was cinema. So you always had some entertainment of some sort. And I used to, the boys were, my two sons were members of the youth club, so that automatically youth club football team. So I used to take my weekends, just be taken up in this football season, running around the island to Decalia and Akrotiri and places like that to the football team, play football. But, they enjoyed it. Well, my eldest son joined the army from Cyprus. In fact, he did his examination, his tests and everything for the army in Cyprus, a colonel in the Ordnance Corps. Sort of sworn him in, and that's where he went from back to Chepstow as a technician, ammunition technician.
So you were out there till 74.
Oh, I was out there till 74.
Were you aware particularly of the problem with Turkey? Because it was that period of the invasion.
Yes.
How did that affect life?
It did affect life actually. The day it happened, it came up on the radio. We didn't know anything about it at the time. But what was happening?
Was it 72?
No, it was 74.
74, sorry.
Yeah, it was 74. And I heard on the radio that there'd been a queue in Cyprus, and then messages started coming through, and the battalion, the Royal Scots at the time, were resident battalion in Episcopi, so they were immediately put on standby and guarding all the necessary places. And we heard that we saw the Greeks moving down past us with all the weapons and artillery and that sort of thing. And then suddenly all the refugees started coming in into what they call Happy Valley in Cyprus. So then the authorities at B said, well, we can't have these people sitting around in Happy Valley. We've got to find a space for them and make a refugee camp if these people want to come in. So they decided on an area down amongst the grapevines, and it's quite a bit of area. The army built, put a 4,000 gallon tank, water tank up on stands for these people, built a kitchen, and put up tents, a hospital tent, a tent for storage, and I went down there to run it. The FD camp, I think we finished up with about 2,000 people in there. And
these were Greek refugees.
These were Greek refugees, yeah. And because I don't know why a lot of them came, because I never saw an angry Turk actually. So I think they came in for. They used to get three meals a day. I mean, in some of the villages they came from up in the hills, they only had one pump anyway, one tap for the whole of the village. So they were happy. They had places to wash their clothes and everything. And I was responsible for sort of ensuring that everybody got fed, and the water was as it should be. Well, the trouble is that they were using so much water that they were running the wells dry. The children were turning the taps on and sitting under it and all this sort of thing, and so running all the water away and wasting it. So what I had to do was, after everything had been done in the morning, like the kitchen, the cooking, and the people had done their washing, people who washed and that sort of thing, I used to take the wheel off, turn the water off, take the wheel off and carry it around with me. And then in the evening, or late in the afternoon, I'd put it on and turn the water back on again. Because we got a message from the authorities saying that, look, we've got to do something, they're running these wells dry. So that's what I had to do. And the people were very friendly. The same old setup. Find a big oak tree, open up a coffee stall, so you could walk around the camp and have a coffee here and a coffee there, this sort of thing. A lot of the men used to go out to work every day on the fields and picking the grapes and that sort of thing. I never eaten many grapes in my life. They used to bring me back a box every night. Sometimes I used to stay overnight if there was something which had to be done sort of early or late at night. I had my own bunk and everything there, so I could stay overnight. And invariably other times I could go home. And the problem was that with the people who were living in Limassol at the time were the families. The men had to come into camp, and the families were brought up onto the sovereign base area, and they were allocated to the families. We had a family of mother and two children, plus my three, which the wife had to look after, which didn't go down very well actually. Because my wife had to run around doing everything for everybody, and that goes for a lot of the people. They were very unhappy with having the people coming up and being. In fact, we had more than that. We had another wife. So I had two wives and three children, plus my three, in the house, in the same house, during this period of the time. And that was a fairly hairy time. The rations themselves, you couldn't get out to the towns. You weren't allowed out at the towns, so we had to work on the assumption that somebody would feed us on the sovereign base area. So what they used to do was bring around the composite rations that we had, that we would need on exercises or use on exercises. And my youngest son used to go down and help in the kitchen, cookhouse, and do different things, different jobs to help out. And but we finally got over it, and I can't quite remember. Somebody, I think we had a captain came and finally took over the refugee camp when we left in September
75.
75.
So you stayed to 75, not 74.
That's 74. I left in September 74, which was things were quieting down. Then we didn't have any. The only disruption we had was the roadblocks in the sovereign base area, the moving of the families up into a sovereign base area to stay with the families.
Did you see much of the Turks?
The Turkish army that came in? No, they didn't. No, they didn't. They didn't come. They only came as far as sort of Nicosia. So we saw quite a bit of movement of the Greek army, but and the Greek National Guard, but nothing of the Turks.
Now, where did you go when you left in September?
Back to Belgium, SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe.
So what were you doing there?
Roughly the same job again. All the accommodation for the British support unit, including the officers' mess. Supporting the officers' mess. I went out there unaccompanied, actually. My wife stayed in the UK.
Now, where was the SHAPE?
Mons.
And you just the same job. Anything about that? Anything you tell that to him?
It was multinational again. In fact, we had Turks, Greeks, who were all working on the mainly police in the area, RMP. You had Royal Marines, Navy, who were working in the offices, running the offices. You had mostly, the rest were mainly Brits. You had the people would come in periodically, and you had to find accommodation for them. People who were like sports programs and that sort of thing, units would come in, and you had to find accommodation for them. And I ran the whole of accommodation. The officers' mess, British officers, that is, where I would look after their setup,